Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Lucy Flores says Joe Biden sniffed her hair and kissed the back of her head. Amy Lapo says he rubbed noses with her. Well, the former vice president has a famously tactile style that these women are saying is unwanted and inappropriate, especially for a potential 2020 presidential candidate, as Lapos told CBS News yesterday.
We are at a critical time in our party, the Democratic Party, in deciding who is going to represent us in 2020. And I know for sure that I do not want a man that does not respect women.
Biden says in a statement that he's offered, quote, countless handshakes, hugs, and expressions of support, and he doesn't believe he acted inappropriately, but he also says he is listening respectfully to the women. The women themselves say it wasn't sexual harassment or assault, but it was unwanted behavior, an invasion, in their words. And beyond politics, that is one of the most important questions the Biden controversy raises, about what constitutes acceptable social mores today, especially in the workplace, and what to do about it. So this hour on Point, Joe Biden, gray areas, and the Me Too movement. And you can join us. What do you make of Biden's interactions with these women? Should it discount him as a 2020 Democratic presidential candidate? And we will be spending the bulk of the hour on this bigger question about how to navigate these new gray areas in the workplace and what to do about it to create an acceptable social work culture. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, let's start first with the political implications for Joe Biden. And joining us from New York is Caitlin Huey Burns, political reporter for CBS News. Caitlin, it's good to have you.
Hi, Meghna. Great to be with you.
So first of all, I'm seeing here that today, in an interview with Politico's Playbook, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is saying that the allegations about Joe Biden are, quote, not disqualifying for a 2020 run, but that he needs to be more mindful of others' personal space. So how is this playing out regarding the Democratic establishment and their view about a Biden candidacy?
Well, you know, it's put them in a very difficult position because Joe Biden is still beloved within the Democratic Party. He was the vice president for a very popular president. President Obama is very popular among Democrats. And people have this affinity for him and think of him as, you know, a longstanding figure in the party. But the party is also going through this reckoning with the Me Too movement, and they had established a pretty high bar trying to claim the moral high ground when they ousted Al Franken from the Senate. You saw this also through the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. Democrats have established kind of a zero tolerance policy, and now they are starting to see these gray areas and instances where things that may not have been disqualifying before are now being raised to another level, or at least introduced in the conversation. And that's what you're hearing from these women, is that they want this to be part of the conversation as they are assessing the candidates. Now, I can tell you, I have been reporting out on the road in New Hampshire, in Iowa, in South Carolina, covering the Democratic 2020 primary. And I always ask about Joe Biden. I always ask voters what they think of Biden. And I have found over and over and over again that many voters love him so much that they almost don't want him to run, because they know there's going to be this extra layer of scrutiny on him, on his behavior, and on his record. Remember, last week, he was having to apologize for his handling of the Anita Hill hearings when he was the Judiciary Committee chairman at the time. And people are starting to revisit his record on a variety of issues, especially on women's issues. And they have other choices now for Democratic nominees. So there was this hurdle, really, for Biden even before these allegations came out. And you hear from Nancy Pelosi this idea of, yes, we do need to have this conversation. Maybe he needs to kind of change the way he interacts with people.
Okay. Well, actually, on the point that you just made, Caitlin, let's go straight to our callers, because Craig is calling from Richmond, Virginia. Craig, you're on the air. What do you think about the allegations against Joe Biden and the impact it might have on a 2020 run if the former vice president throws his hat into the ring?
Hey, thank you. I guess I'm surprised that I'm not hearing anybody put this in the context of who we have serving in the White House. We have a president who has admitted to sexually assaulting women, to grabbing them, a dozen or more other women who have claimed they've sexually harassed or assaulted them. And I think this is just Joe Biden, very personal style. I think I would have voted for him last time. Not sure he needs to run this time. But it seems to be a double standard the way that we're approaching him. And all of the talk around this point is, you know, missing the fact that what Trump has admitted to. So I'd like to hear your guest thoughts on that.
Yeah, Craig, thank you so much for your call. So Caitlin Huey Burns, this is something that that Democrats will have to grapple with, because it is a serious consideration about whether or not the party has, or actually I should say that politics as writ large has a double standard about behavior.
Right. And it's a really interesting question. I appreciate that question. And this is something that Democratic primary voters are having to navigate on a variety of fronts, not only on behavior, but on experience, on record. And they can look at it kind of two different ways. One, because of the criticisms that they have of the current president, do they want someone who can contrast with him on those issues of behavior, of experience, on other things? Or do they say, well, look at the guy in the White House. Do we actually need this standard in our party?
Yeah.
And so it is a really interesting question that they're going to have to navigate. And I think the conversation that voters are having comes at a time that there are a record number of women running for the Democratic nomination. They've already made history by the number of women running. And we saw in the 2018 elections that women played a critical role in terms of the voter base driving Democratic turnout. So these conversations are kind of elevated now. And there are these questions about what kind of candidate they want that reflects these values that they have.
Right.
Now, I will say it's really important to note that there are many women who have come forward and vouched for Joe Biden. And I think it's important to highlight that people that have worked with him, that have been with him behind the scenes, who vouch for his character, vouch for this behavior being none other than a show of affection and affinity for women.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say that Susan Rice, former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., former advisor to President Obama, she just tweeted yesterday, I believe, saying, quote, "I respect every woman who chooses to share her uncomfortable and worse experiences with men. Their perspectives must be heard and taken seriously." But then Rice goes on to write that, "I have worked closely with Joe Biden for many years. In my experience, he is warm and affectionate with women and men, but never have I found his actions inappropriate or uncomfortable." So that's one of those women throwing their support behind Joe Biden. But I wanted to ask you, Caitlin, about how this issue is playing out amongst those women who are running for president right now, as you pointed out, particularly Kristen Gillibrand, right? Because she was out front in calling for the ouster of former Senator Al Franken, even before the Senate ethics investigation completed on the allegations against him. She was then later dogged by a story that her own staff didn't appropriately handle misconduct allegations with one of her senior staffers. So how is this all playing out for candidates like Gillibrand?
Well, it is really interesting, because you do have a candidate like Gillibrand who was really leading the charge in the Senate to oust Al Franken, even though most of the women senators ended up backing her on that. And she has made it a critical piece of her campaign. She's been asked about it a lot, and she has defended her stance against that, saying that, you know, she couldn't explain to her son how to handle this unless she was going forward and calling for Al Franken to resign, saying that this behavior was not okay. But many of the women candidates were asked yesterday about Joe Biden, and they said that they believe Lucy Flores, who at the time those were the allegations coming out the first time, and that they, you know, didn't have a comment, though, about whether Biden should get into the race. And that's why you're hearing them kind of walk this tightrope a little bit, because there is this call to believe the women when they come forward with allegations. But now they are facing some nuances that are involved in this. Joe Biden, especially being such a revered member of the party, But their candidacies, I think, speak for a lot. The fact that Joe Biden hasn't discouraged anybody else from running for president, especially women, I think speaks a lot about where the party is right now. They have a diverse set of candidates. They have a lot of candidates. And nobody is a front runner, especially not the former vice president, which I think speaks a lot about where the party is.
Yeah. So we just have about a minute and a half left here, Caitlin. What do we know about where Biden himself or what he's thinking now about whether or not he's going to decide to run?
Well, you know, he has been really agonizing over this decision to run before these allegations came out or before this even the topic came to involve him. And this really does show the perils of that lingering, that agonizing over this decision. As I mentioned before, there were lots of criticisms being leveraged at Joe Biden for his record, for this question of whether the Democratic Party has moved on from him, whether he still represents what the Democratic Party is right now. On issues, on behavior, on rhetoric. After 2016, lots of Democrats thought that he could have defeated Donald Trump. That is the premium that voters are placing on candidates right now. Can this person defeat Donald Trump? And so this is why these conversations are important for Democrats, they believe, to be discussing, because they want a candidate that they believe in, are passionate about, and are excited about. And yeah. So the longer that he waits, the more questions come out. Again, not only about this, but about his record, and raise questions about kind of where he fits into the party. That's what he'll have to answer.
Well, Caitlin Huey Burns, political reporter for CBS News with us from New York. Thank you so much for joining us, Caitlin.
Thank you.
Well, when we come back, we're going to take a closer look at all those questions that dwell in the gray areas that this Biden story has asked us to consider, gray areas that all Americans have to navigate these days. We're going to push this question beyond the realm of politics and into our everyday lives. We'll do that when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the allegations of unwanted touching made against former Vice President Joe Biden, but really more deeply about the gray areas and complex social mores that we should all be looking at in the era of the Me Too movement. Now, one of the allegations was made by Lucy Flores. She's a former Nevada assemblywoman. And here's a little more about what she wrote about her experience. She wrote it in New York Magazine. She wrote, quote, "I'm not suggesting that Biden broke any laws, but the transgressions that society deems minor or doesn't even see as transgressions often feel considerable to the person on the receiving end. That imbalance of power and attention is the whole point and the whole problem," end quote. Well, Lucy Flores elaborated on what she meant when she spoke to CBS News on Friday.
It's not about the intent. It is about the person on the receiving end of that behavior, that unwanted behavior, and the way in which it makes that person feel, especially in a situation where you have that kind of a power imbalance going on. You have the second most powerful person in the country, arguably one of the most powerful men in the entire world, and someone who does not have that kind of power, a woman who does not have that kind of power.
That's Lucy Flores on CBS News on Friday. We know a similar observation can be made outside of politics and inside every American workplace. It is the considerable gray area that the Me Too movement is asking everyone to examine. How are these gray areas between impressions and intent, how are they being handled in your workplace? There are things like HR training sessions that are meant to prevent and educate employees on these types of situations, but do they work? And over a year after the inception of the Me Too movement, or the rise of the Me Too movement, what responsibilities do employers have to change the workplace? Well, joining us today from Miami, Florida, is Maran Valbrun. She's an employee relations professional who provides trainings to Fortune 100 and 500 companies. She's also got a background in employment law and is author of Me Too, A Practical Guide to Navigating Today's Cultural Workplace Revolution. Maran, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you, Magna. Pleasure to join you.
It's great to have you. Also with us from Eugene, Oregon, is Elizabeth Tippett, University of Oregon law professor. Her research on the evolution of sexual harassment trainings from 1980 to 2016 has been published in the Berkeley Journal of Employment and Labor Law. Professor Tippett, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, so Maran, let me just first start with you. You heard that tape we played from Lucy Flores' interview on CBS News. React to that. What is she talking about? Or tell us what your reaction is to Flores saying that really the issue isn't, in her mind, perhaps even sexual harassment, but just the sheer imbalance of power and how that plays out in the workplace.
I think that she makes a very telling and powerful point. In my experience, there's a very strong difference between intent versus impact, which is what she also speaks to, which is that very often, you know, I've heard a dozen complaints, right, where you might have the complainant come in and say, this is what happened. This is how I experienced it. It was only myself and the other individual in the room. And then you ultimately interview the alleged harasser. And you would think that if there were only two people in the room, that the alleged harasser would come in and say, no, that didn't happen. That wasn't the experience. But more often than not, what I've found is that they come in and they say, yes, that's exactly what happened. However, that's not what my intent was. I did not mean to make them uncomfortable. And so, you know, to the extent that you have someone who's in a position of power, who's acting in a little bit of a bubble, or who's not really considering having a full and robust perspective as to how their actions are impacting someone else, especially someone who's in a position of less power than them, then they can have a really profound impact on the individual that they're influencing.
Mm. Well, Elizabeth Tippett, we'll talk more in a few minutes about sort of training efforts in the workplace and whether or not they're effective. But I'm wondering if you might just respond to what Maran is saying here. And should we have higher expectations of people, especially more powerful employees or superiors in a workplace, to know what the impact of their actions or of what their actions might be on people?
Well, so if we were thinking about the Joe Biden story in a workplace context, the most important question is actually not whether the conduct was sexual. It's actually whether the conduct was motivated by gender. And so you might imagine a situation where kissing somebody on the back of the head can be demeaning, can be patronizing. Reminds me a little bit, actually, of when President George W. Bush gave German Chancellor Angela Merkel a back rub at a meeting. Right. So how might that kind of behavior affect whether someone's performance in the workplace? And so when you think about harassment as a legal question, it's, is this conduct interfering with work in a way that would prevent them from doing their job and advance in the workplace? That's the most important question, actually.
And so how would you, I mean, it's hard. So that's a question that's hard to answer, right? So sticking to the Biden context here for a minute, I mean, even Flores herself is saying she doesn't call it, she doesn't see it as sexual assault at all, or harassment even. She called it more of an invasion. So how do you How do you handle that in the workplace? Because perhaps there wasn't a direct line between those actions and a person's capacity to do their work.
I do think, though, this is emblematic of underrepresentation of women in politics. This was at a political rally, and I do think we have a tendency to infantilize women, and it is sort of only generally women who are subject to, you know, things like being pat on the head or being kissed on the back of the head. And I think you have to have a conversation of, you know, you need to stop treating women like they're children, and have a broader conversation of, are we thinking about women in a way that gives them parity and equality on the political stage or any workplace stage where we can imagine them being leaders, or, for example, having gravitas? It's hard to assign gravitas to someone if you treat them and view them as a small child.
Maran, what do you think about that?
I think that speaks to the broader issue of micro inequities in the workplace. You know, so definitely within the sexual harassment and sexual discrimination sphere, you know, when you look at the way that women are treated in general in the workplace, you know, to Elizabeth's point, are they being somehow interrupted more in meetings? Are their points not being taken as seriously? Are they ignored when they make an important point? Whereas, you know, when the gentleman makes a point, a male coworker makes a point, then that's revered or that's responded to, or there's more reaction to that. And then, you know, once you have an environment, a workplace environment, where there are those types of disparities in terms of the way that women versus male employees may be treated, then it may set the groundwork and the stage for worse treatment in terms of their interactions, their gender-based interactions that may become much worse.
Okay, so let me ask you, you do trainings, employee trainings for Fortune 100 companies. What exactly are you training for when you meet with employees?
It depends. Typically, I couch it in professionalism in the workplace. And so that can be a broad spectrum of things, bullying, how you interact and show respect to your workers on a day-to-day basis. Additionally, Title VII EOC type issues, so race discrimination, age discrimination, disability discrimination, and sexual discrimination. And then in addition to that, I speak to sexual harassment and what that looks like.
And so how does it go? I mean, because I guess what I'm trying to explore here or figure out is, if we're talking about fundamentally what both of you are calling for are very basic but profound culture shifts, right? In every American workplace, is that something that can be affected through trainings? I mean, Maran, you do in person trainings. Have you seen that have a transformative effect in the places that you've worked?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that it's important that the training be designed to be effective. So I do encourage employers and companies to engage live trainings over the WebExes or the web-based trainings, because there's an opportunity for engagement and interactivity and for question asking, which is so important for adult learners and for people in the workplace. It needs to be practical and not mired in legalese, easy to understand, so that it's so that employees and managers can walk away with next steps and understandings. You know, it has to. I typically encourage employers to make it 1 to 2 hours. In some states, like California, for example, have legal requirements around trainings that they be at least 2 hours. I separate managers and employees because they are two populations that have distinct interests and questions and responsibilities. And so, you know, typically a training should not include both populations. Also, these live trainings offer an opportunity for role play, for examples. I really like during these trainings to discuss case scenarios that involve the type of ambiguities that we're seeing with this Joe Biden situation, or even more ambiguous sort of gray situations that can spark robust conversation around some of these complexities that don't have any easy answers.
Well, so Elizabeth Tippett, I'm going to turn back to you in a second here, but on this point that you're making, Moran, what do people say? How do they respond or think through these gray areas? In when you bring them up in terms of these actual cases or examples, do you find that there's disagreement amongst the employees that you're working with on what the appropriate way to handle a particularly gray area situation might be, or if any transgression was even made?
Absolutely. Yeah. And the case scenarios are designed that way so that reasonable people could differ. You know, and once I see that there is disagreement, that there are differing points of view amongst the attendees, then that's when it gets good. That's when I'm excited that there's learning that's happening and that's possible, because people learn from each other and they see that there are very widely varying perspectives on the same set of facts, which is what I find time and time again as I look into and as I investigate these sexual harassment issues. So I think the number one takeaway amongst the attendees is that, you know, what I might find to be perfectly acceptable, others may not. So I need to err on the side of caution, over-communicate, ask for permission, you know, do all of these things that allow me to interact successfully, effectively, and respectfully with my coworkers on a day-to-day basis.
So, Elizabeth Tippett, let me turn back to you here, because what Moran is saying here, it tracks closely with, for example, a comment that we received on our website. Bill 98 says, at the moment, there is too much room for misunderstanding, and in Bill's words, even malevolence in the form of false accusations. A single accusation, even if lacking incredible evidence, can be ruinous for certain people. So how would you respond to Bill's concerns?
Well, I would say that in my experience, employers are pretty diligent when it comes to investigating harassment complaints. And they also, at least prior to Me Too, were pretty motivated not to find harassment. And so if there was a lot of evidence suggesting that the complaint was completely fabricated, I don't think they would have very much trouble siding with the accused, at least before the Me Too movement, maybe less so now. But they do tend to be very evidence-based and look at what are the inconsistencies and what are people saying and what are the text messages and what are the emails and what did other witnesses see. So in my experience as a lawyer, I did not see a lot of situations involving overtly fabricated harassment complaints.
Mm. Well, you've done a lot of research on what trainings are, or the effectiveness of HR training since 1980. And 1980 is an important year for us to focus on for a second, because remind us why it is that we've began to see a lot of these workplace training modules starting in that year.
So in 1980, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission issued a series of guidelines where they were defining harassment and sexual harassment in particular in a way that predated the actual law, because the Supreme Court didn't come out and recognize sexual harassment or harassment generally until 1986. So they took this very aggressive definition of sexual harassment as a guideline, and that motivated employers to want to adopt and enhance policies and to start training people on harassment. And so those guidelines actually are what influenced training modules even today, even now that the law has actually somewhat changed since then, but it tends to hold over in the trainings.
Okay. And so have you found that the trainings are effective or not?
So it's a mixed bag. If you have a workplace that has no history of any kind of training in harassment, it could be really helpful to provide a harassment training that conveys basic information, that tells people what the complaint process is, that tells people how to complain. If they don't know that, a training could be really effective in that realm. Where there is less evidence is the idea that a training will transform people's behavior or transform their attitudes, which have been formed over a long period of time. I think it's unrealistic to expect a one-hour training or even a two-hour training to transform someone's worldview.
Right. I mean, and especially we, you know, Moran does trainings that are in person, right? And a lot of workplaces, however, opt for online training or video-based tutorials. And I'm seeing there's some evidence or research here that those kinds of HR trainings can actually backfire and make people or make situations worse or underscore some of the worst stereotypes about people.
I mean, I think that's a risk for all types of trainings. I don't necessarily want to start from the proposition that online trainings are necessarily bad. I've seen some really interesting stuff on YouTube. I think online trainings could be interesting as a form of, you know, data gathering and improvement and refinement over time as you see how people are reacting to it. So I don't necessarily want to start from the presumption that live trainings will always be better. I think we could do better at trying a YouTube-type tutorial or an interactive online training.
Mm. Well, Elizabeth Tippett and Moran Velbrun, stand by here for just a second. We've got comments coming in online. For example, Mike Palmer says, there should be boundaries to touching in the office. A couple of common man-on-man forms of socially uncomfortable touching. The faint punch to the chest, the famous backslap, these perpetuate an environment of toxic masculinity. Whereas Suzanne Tatham says, please keep speaking your truths, but men in my childhood, Suzanne says, were revered for showing affection. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about Joe Biden and gray areas in the Me Too movement and how to navigate them at work and create a workplace culture where everyone feels comfortable and there's a clarity around expectations and social mores. We're joined today by Moran Velbrun. She's an employee relations professional and provides employee training for Fortune 100 and 500 companies and is author of Me Too, A Practical Guide to Navigating Today's Cultural Workplace Revolution. Elizabeth Tippett also joins us. She's a law professor at the University of Oregon and has done research, extensive research, on the evolution of sexual harassment trainings from 1980 to 2016. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Laura, who's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Laura, you're on the air.
Thank you. Great conversation today. You know, one of the things I thought of today while listening was the narrative traditionally and historically has been pretty much set by men as far as how to talk about this and what even is harassment. So, of course, men are going to be uncomfortable when they are really confronted by women and even other men about how their behavior is affecting them. So when I hear a man come on your show and say, well, you know, there's, you know, we're going too far in the other direction. Well, that's part of righting wrongs. I mean, there's going to be people that are super sensitive and, you know, a kiss on the head is going to really bother them. Other people, you know, are getting really heavily harassed physically. So there's going to be uncomfortableness. And I think men need to really just listen to women. And that is going to be hard because that's not typically the position they've been in.
Right. Laura, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Jude, who's calling from Montpelier, Vermont. Jude, you're on the air. What do you think of what Laura from Des Moines just said?
Well, my point is, and I'm coming from the perspective of a middle-aged woman who's no longer called, you know, babe and never really had abundant female allure. But I have to say, without wanting to sound politically too incorrect, that I think we're losing a sense of humor in a large way and touch and nuance. And that I think, as much as I agree that higher expectations are a given, especially, I mean, politically, of course, that walking on eggshells, and I think it's getting to the point where we don't even allow someone like Biden to have self-reflection. And He is stopping. He is having self-reflection. But at this point, I think we're all losing the ability to just be human. I myself might be considered a predator. I say that with humor. But, I mean, sniffing hair, putting your arm around someone, I think it's human community, especially when you work closely with people in an environment. I work in the arts, but I think it's the same issue. I think we're losing a sense of humor.
Mm. Well, Jude, thank you so much for your call. Moran Valbrun, let me turn to you with that. So you heard two very different opinions on whether or not sensitivity has gone too far, or that's an appropriate correction based on, you know, the past or some would even say current injustices that women especially or people of color experiencing in the workplace. What's your response to that variety we just heard?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting to hear those two very different perspectives. And with regard to the second caller who says, look, you know, we're taking ourselves too seriously, that actions like Joe Biden's are fine and that she would invite them, then, you know, that speaks to her sensitivities, that she would invite them. And I think that we need to be aware that there are some who wouldn't. And so it's really a question, definitely in today's workplace, about assessing where people's comfort levels are, individual comfort levels, rather than projecting what we individually, you know, personally might be comfortable with and thinking that they should be too, just because we would be.
Okay, so can I just jump in here? Because yeah. I think this is a very crucial point that you're making, and I would love to tap your experience on how to find the answer to this question that you're asking. I mean, here's an example. Say, you know, and I've read hypotheticals like this, that say there's a male supervisor who also believes that mentorship is an important part of his role in his organization. Mm-hmm. And he sees a talented young woman that deserves mentorship and says, let's go out to lunch and sort of build a better workplace relationship. And perhaps in the context of that lunch, maybe he asks a question or two that she feels uncomfortable with. But because of the power imbalance, she doesn't necessarily say that it was uncomfortable, and he finds out later. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, how can supervisors or more powerful people in a workplace, what are the tools they have or should use to gauge what those sensitivities actually are so that there's no misinterpretation between intent and how something was received?
Okay, so first and foremost, I would say that in that scenario, it's good that the supervisor is taking the subordinate out to lunch, or more importantly, underlying that they have the motive of mentoring that subordinate. It's good that they have the intent of mentoring the subordinate. So first and foremost, I don't want anyone to take away from this conversation or this dialogue the sense that they should not engage as a means of avoiding any perception that, you know, that the individual is being harassed or that there's, you know, any inappropriate interaction. So that's one. But in the course of interacting with the subordinate, then I think it's a matter of communication, of stating intent, you know, of saying, look, I like to connect with the people that I work with or who work for me. I like to mentor. And for me, part of that is knowing a little bit more about you and makes you tick and asking you questions that might not be specific to work, but I'd like to check with you. I'd like to, you know, do a sense check that that's okay with you, that you understand that that's where I'm coming from and that that's an approach that jives well with you. You know, and if not, then I'll redirect. So I think that it's important for people in positions of power, you know, who are looking to do things like mentor or engage with individuals who work for them or with them, to be over communicative, but not disengage.
Okay, interesting. Elizabeth Tippett, did you want to respond to that?
Well, I think it is a problem if people respond to the Me Too movement by saying, well, I'm just not going to mentor women anymore, because that's their obligation under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. So harassment is a form of discrimination, but there are also other forms of discrimination. And so failing to provide the opportunities that all workers need in order to advance themselves in the workplace force and be promoted and get equal pay. You need to provide that to everyone. So it's actually not acceptable to respond to Me Too by saying, well, I'm just never going to invite women out to lunch ever again because I'm worried I might say the wrong thing.
Well, I guess I was just asking the question from the perspective of, you know, we're talking about sort of an evolution, a critical evolution in the workplace, which means a lot of learning for a lot of people. And there are folks out there, well, we're going to hear from them because I'm going to go back to the phones here in a second, who might ask, well, aren't there many situations where it's impossible for someone to know exactly how their actions might be received? And are we putting too much, are we expecting too much of people to be able to read other people's minds if we don't have systems in place to communicate the difference between intent and perception? Does that make sense?
Sure. So what I would say is the legal standard for harassment is very, very high. So really none of the situations we've talked about so far come even close to meeting the legal standard of harassment. So when you're below the legal standard of harassment, all of the rest of this stuff is culturally negotiated. And negotiated between the employer and their workforce about how they want to define harassment in their workplace. And that's the tough situation we're in now. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as a legal matter, you're not harassing someone unless a reasonable person objectively would consider that behavior highly offensive and the person is actually offended by the behavior and the behavior is either very frequent or very severe. That's a really, really high standard. So what we're talking about here is a cultural definition of harassment.
Right. In fact, that legal standard is so high, it's amazing what things have been found as not constituting harassment. I can't even read the descriptions of some of the things that have happened in workplaces.
But that's exactly right.
Let's go back to the phone. Let's go to Brett, who's calling from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Brett, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I just wanted to comment because I'm a graduate student at a big university and have TA or teaching assistant position. And in doing that, I mean, we're trained on this as most of us 20-somethings, early 30s, trained on this. You know, you're in a position of power. You hold authority. You should treat that as that you can have influence on the younger students, especially students of opposing genders. And I just feel like when hearing about this and the excuses that get made for, especially, it just seems like white men in power, it's frustrating because, I mean, we're being taught, especially as a younger person, you know, there's things that you can't do, you can't get away with. But then when you see it, it's kind of like it gets dismissed even by, I feel like even by women sometimes. Mm. And so I guess I'm just wondering, like, if we dismiss behavior like this and we kind of just brush it off as normal, we're missing this opportunity to have a discussion about gender inequity. And really, I feel like it stymies women's ability and also women of color's ability to move up in the workplace because it seems like it, and I'm glad that y'all are having that discussion. So I guess I just want to emphasize that, I mean, these conversations are happening and the young workforce, I hope, is discussing this gray area with Aziz Ansari and all of that came up. But I hope that we get it for the older white men, the CEOs, the vice presidents, the senators.
Right. Well, you know, Brett, I'm going to take it back from you there because your point's well taken. And I think at least Joe Biden might say now that he's having that conversation whether or not he wants to have it. But thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Hamburg, New York. Jim, you're on the air.
Good morning. The Me Too movement has created a hostile and adversarial workplace environment. I was a teacher here in Western New York, and there was a time when we would banter and have good-natured conversations and joke amongst each other. And when this Me Too movement came along, everybody now on pins and needles. As an example, I said to a young lady, I don't know how old she was, that she looked very nice this morning. She was dressed very well, and she looked at me and she says, "What do you mean by that?" And that was the last time I ever spoke to her. And the last time I ever had any kind of interaction with her.
Hey,
and,
Jim,
Jim,
I'm going to just jump in here. Don't hang up because I just want to ask you a couple quick questions. One is when she asked, "What do you mean by that?" How did you respond? Did you tell her what
I
you
walked
meant?
Away.
So I walked away.
I'm not gonna deal with that.
Oh, but so she maybe she gave you an opportunity.
You don't understand. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if so you chose to walk away, but we could also see it as her maybe giving you an opportunity to have a dialogue. Like we've been talking, that might be the way forward here. What do you think?
That's what I mean. You can't walk around with your feelings on your coat sleeves and your shirt sleeve, whatever. I said that she, does that need an explanation? I was paying her a compliment. I mean, that she looked very nice. I didn't say anything that she was gorgeous, beautiful. I said, really nice. She had a nice dress on and whatever she had, had on. And all of a sudden, what do you mean by that? There becomes this defensive posture. And I was a teacher, believe me, and everybody, the majority of people in the building were women. And all of a sudden, after this Me Too thing came on out, the defensiveness and the hostility, and everybody's looking over their shoulder.
Hey, Jim, I'm running out of time here, but I want to ask you one more quick question. You know, I hear you saying that you feel like the workplace is everyone's walking around on pins and needles because of the Me Too movement. But the flip side to that is has this allowed you to recognize that a lot of people have felt like they for years or decades or generations, you know, if they're women, have been walking around on pins and needles or feeling that they were in a hostile environment but just could never talk about it. So, like, the tables have just turned. What do you think about that?
Well, that's your perception.
I'm just asking you.
I think that's totally wrong. I mean, all the principals I ever worked for in the schools, they were always women. They always were in a state of power. Nobody had any problem. We used to laugh and joke and go out together as a group, men and women, talk about our... And all of a sudden now we've got this... you can't say this, or you can't do that thing. So we're fine.
Well,
we go out by ourselves.
Yeah. Jim, forgive me. I really don't mean to interrupt you. I just literally have 2 minutes and 30 seconds left in the show, and you've said a lot that I want our guests to reflect on. So thank you so much for your call. Maron Valbrun, what do you think of Jim's perspective of the workplace today after 30 years as a teacher?
Well, you know, you asked Jim whether or not it's possible that the women felt the way that he does now, that they were walking around on pins and needles, and he said that's wrong. And, you know, I would argue that it's very difficult for Jim to know what these women were feeling. And so, again, it really goes back to this issue of exercising perspective, like really trying to understand that people come into the workplace with a variety of perspectives just by virtue of the fact that you have a number of different people with different experiences and sensitivities in this one place. And so now if Me Too is bringing awareness to the fact that many people have felt stifled in the past and are now feel empowered to speak to their experiences and speak to what they felt uncomfortable about, then this is really an opportunity for Jim and for everyone to hear these voices that might not have otherwise felt empowered to speak in the past.
Well, Elizabeth Tippett, we've just got about 30 seconds left to go. I wanted to give you a chance to have a final say today.
I guess, you know, it's not harassment to tell someone you look nice today. But the question is the only interaction you're having with this person or the primary interaction this employee is having with everybody else is for them to comment on their appearance? And then if that's the case, what does that say about whether this person has an equal opportunity to succeed in this workplace and an equal opportunity for advancement?
Well, Elizabeth Tippett, law professor at the University of Oregon, has done extensive research on the evolution of sexual harassment trainings in the workplace. Professor Tippett, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Maron Valbrun, an employee relations professional providing employee training for Fortune 100 and 500 companies and author of Me Too, A Practical Guide to Navigating Today's Cultural Workplace Revolution. Maron, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.